Good day, readers, and welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we're continuing our journeys around the Southern Hemisphere. I've just returned from a great trip to Australia and Tasmania. Ooh, sounds exotic, doesn't it? And as always, I've been checking in with readers around the world. So what are our friends the Aussies reading? Many of the same titles you and I have been picking up, and some different ones. Ready to explore Australian writers? Good on you. We'll get down to it.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign, at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
G'day, readers. I'm here at the Sydney Airport, and I'm speaking with Jonathan at the Watermark Bookshop. I'm asking him, what are travelers in Australia reading? What's current? What's hot?
Well, currently, we sell quite a lot of Australian fiction here, and also a lot of British fiction, I suppose, and not too much American fiction. So you're...
That's all right. Tell us, what are the top Australian writers these days?
Courtney is a very popular author, and
what are some of his top titles that we could find in the States?
The Power of One is probably his best known book, and his latest book is called Fortune Cookie. That's been very popular. And Peter Carey, who your readers would know, he now lives in the United States. He's very popular. This has been a very good seller, The Room by Emma Donoghue.
Actually, we've previewed that on the show. She's wonderful.
Yes. It's actually a very interesting book. Jeffrey Archer is always popular. Only Time Will Tell is one of our big sellers. And as always, Patricia Cornwell has a relatively new book, The Scarpetta Factor. It's been very popular.
How are the Dragon Tattoo books selling here?
Oh, they have sold very well. They've fallen off a little bit recently because they've been around for a while. But the third one in the series is selling very well because the movie has just opened here.
What's on the curriculum for Australian high schoolers?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I do know the Great Gatsby is often part of the curriculum, and Shakespeare, and I'm not all that well up on the school curriculum in Australia, but I don't think it's all that different as far as English literature goes. Yeah, I just wanted to show you that as far as our non-fiction goes, this has been consistently one of our best sellers over the last year or so. A Little History of the World by Gombrich.
Is Gombrich an Australian author?
No, he's German, and he passed away, I think, 20-odd years ago, maybe more. But it's a recent translation. It was available in German for many years, and now it's available in English for the first time, and it sells extremely well. Another book that's been very popular is The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge. It's a book that I've actually read myself. It's extremely interesting. If you're at all interested in psychology or neurology, it would be of interest.
What titles should our listeners pick up if they wanted to really get a good introduction to Australian writing today?
Well, Peter Temple is probably Australia's top crime writer. He's won many awards in Australia and is fairly well known internationally. Another very popular writer is Marcus Zusak, whose book, The Book Thief, has sold extremely well all over the world. And I would recommend it to anybody, really.
Americans are very familiar with Colleen McCullough and the Thornbirds. Yes, is she still writing?
Yes, she is.
Naked Cruelty. Yes. That's a new title from...
It's a new title, and it's part of a series. It's a Carmine Delmonico novel.
What kind of series is that? Is it crime or just women's literature? Or
crime. It's a crime thriller. It's actually set in America in 1968.
All right. We'll look for that. Thank you. Jonathan, thanks so much. This is great news for our American listeners.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Bye now.
Thank you.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really? And how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow. Social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
One of Bryce Courtenay's famous Australian trilogy is The Potato Factory. Many say the main character, Ikey Solomon, is actually based on Fagin from Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist. Indeed, Ikey is a very successful thief in London until he and his mistress, Mary Abacus, must each make the harsh journey from thriving 19th century London to the convict settlement of Van Diemen's Land, which is now Tasmania. In the back streets and dives of Hobart Town, Mary learns the art of brewing and builds the potato factory where she plans a new future. But her ambitions are threatened by Ikey's wife, Hannah, her old enemy. The two women raise their separate families, one legitimate, the other not. As each woman sets out to destroy the other, the families are brought to the edge of disaster. In the tradition of Dickens, Courtenay creates a unique cast of characters from the outset of this epic novel. Narrator Humphrey Bower's performance makes this one of the rare books with a sweep of characters you'll come to care about deeply. For your reference, book two of this trilogy is Tomo and Hawk, and book three is Solomon's Song. Though Courtenay was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, he emigrated to Australia early in adult life and had a high-profile career in advertising as creative director of some top ad agencies, including McCann Erickson and J. Walter Thompson. His most famous novel is The Power of One. His many years in Australia, though, have given him an amazing voice that captures the depth and breadth of the Australian continent. Let's listen.
The gateman turned away from her to address the vaguely defined line of men stretching away behind Mary.
Now then, gentlemen. My name's Sergeant William Lawrence, late of the 40th Regiment, veteran of the Peninsular War, wounded in action at the Battle of Waterloo. I am the gatekeeper here, and I'll brook no interference. It will be one at a time through the gate, no pushing and shoving and no idle chatter, if you please.
There was a murmur in the crowd at the sound of a carriage rattling over distant cobblestones, and then the rumble of its wheels as it drew onto the wooden dockside, and shortly afterwards came to a halt at the gate, the horse snuffling and shaking its head, blowing frosted air from its distended nostrils. Mary, who stood close enough to see clearly, observed a small, very fat man alight. He was dressed in a heavy coat, which swept to within an inch of the ground in the manner of a woman's skirt, his shoes being quite lost from sight. He wore a top hat which sat upon his head down almost to his eyes, and rose alarmingly high into the air for a man so short. The remaining space between head and shoulders was wrapped in a woollen scarf, so that in the uncertainty of the mist, the whole of him took on the proportions of a very large perambulating bottle. The gatekeeper snapped to immediate attention and gave the bottle shape a rigid salute, his jowls and sideburns quivering with the momentum of it.
"Morning, Mr. Goldstein, sir!"
Sergeant Lawrence shouted at the very top of his voice, as though addressing the commander of a battalion of soldiers who was about to embark on a parade inspection.
"Good morning,"
the bottle replied in a muffled voice. Then, without glancing at the line of men, it entered the gate and waddled into the mist towards the unseen warehouse not 20 feet away. The gatekeeper, pushing his hand between two brass buttons and into the interior of the greatcoat, pulled from within it a watch chain, which soon enough produced a large, though not expensive-looking watch. Glancing down at it from under his peaked cap, he addressed the queue.
"I shall allow 5 minutes for Mr. Goldstein to settle, and then the first in the line will proceed through the gate to the door. You will oblige Mr. Goldstein by knocking on the outside door, whereupon you will remove your hat and proceed in an inwardly direction and without waiting for an answer. Mr. Goldstein will be in the office to the left of the door upon which you shall again knock and then immediately enter. For then what is ambidextrous and hasn't had the misfortune to have been trained in His Majesty's military forces, the left side is the side what's got the coat stand."
Anxious laughter came from the mist as men strained to catch every word, fearful of the consequences of making a mistake. The imperious Sergeant Lawrence looked down at his watch again and then glanced sternly at Mary.
"Goldstein, you understand, miss? Mr. Goldstein!"
Mary nodded, feeling herself beginning to tremble. Mary knocked on the outer door of the warehouse, and then, without waiting for a reply, did as she had been told and entered. To her left was a heavy freestanding coat stand, on which hung the overgrown top hat, together with its owner's coat and scarf. Behind it was a door with a frosted glass upper panel, on which, in gold relief lettering, was the name Jacob Goldstein, proprietor. The door seemed designed especially for Mr. Goldstein, for it was not an inch higher than 5 feet, though 1.5 times as wide as one might normally expect an office door to be. Mary tapped nervously on the surface of the glass, her heart pounding in her ears, her knees feeling light, as though they might give at any moment, and the palms of her hands were wet.
"You must be here coming, please,"
a voice answered in an accent which Mary immediately recognised. She had spent her childhood around Rosemary Lane and the Whitechapel markets, and the accent was unmistakably that of a German Jew. Mary entered and curtsied to the man, who sat well back from a large desk. He was dressed in a morning suit, and his huge stomach, she felt certain, would not permit his very short arms to reach to the edge of the desk, the top of which contained a pot of blacking and a goose quill pen, a large writing tablet, and a medium-sized brass bell of the kind a schoolmaster might use to summon his pupils from play.
"Good morning, Mr. Goldstein," Mary said, summoning all her courage into a nervous smile.
Mr. Goldstein seemed astonished to see her and commenced immediately to bluster.
Carey is an Australian novelist, and I'm thinking many of you might be familiar with his work. He also got his start in advertising and actually lived in New York for a time, teaching creative writing at NYU. Carey is one of only two writers, the other being South African J.M. Coetzee, to have won the prestigious Booker Prize 2 times. He won the first time in 1988 for Oscar and Lucinda, and the second time in 2001 with True History of the Kelly Gang. He is frequently named as Australia's next contender for the Nobel Prize in Literature. His new work, Parrot and Olivier in America, is set at the beginning of the 19th century, a tumultuous and unstable time for French politics. By 1830, the once thriving monarchy had endured multiple rounds of rebellion marked by terror, political unrest, and macabre guillotine executions. As a child of the aristocracy, Olivier is in danger. He travels to the young country of America with an English servant named Parrot to study the American penal system and to escape the inevitable threat to his survival amid revolutionary France. In Parrot and Olivier in America, we are able to see what the United States was like in its first 50 years through the eyes of these two protagonists. Theirs is an unlikely partnership. Parrot is a struggling printer approaching his 50s, while Olivier is an old-world aristocrat, a character actually based on Alexis de Tocqueville, the 19th-century French political scientist and author of Democracy in America. With their story, Peter Carey explores the adventure of the new American democracy with dazzling inventiveness. The book is read again by Humphrey Bauer.
We must be prepared to push my uncle's hobby across fallen branches through the spinneys. It is almost useless in the rough ground of the woods, where I and the Abbé de Lalande, my beloved bébé, shot so many hundreds of larks and sparrows that I bruised my little shoulder blue. Careful, Olivier dear. Do be careful. We can ignore nosebleeding for the time being, although to be realistic, the blood can be anticipated soon enough. Spectacular spurts, splendid gushes. My body being always too thin-walled a container for the passions coursing through its veins. But as we are making up our adventure, let us assume there is no blood, no compresses, no leeches, no wild gallops to drag the doctor from his breakfast. And so we readers can leave the silky, treacherous Seine and cross the rough woodlands and enter the path between the linden trees. And I, Olivier Jean-Baptiste de Clarel de Barfleur de Garmont, a noble of myopia, am free to speed like Mercury while pointing out the blurry vegetable garden on the left, the smudgy watercolor of orchard on the right. Here is the ordure of the village road across which I can go sailing, skidding, blind as a bat, through the open gates of the Chateau de Barfleur. Hello, Jacques. Hello, Gustave. Odile. I am home. On the right, just inside, is Papa's courthouse, where he conducts the marriages of young peasants, thus saving them military service and early death in Napoleon's army. It does not need to be said that we are not for Bonaparte, and my Papa leaves the intrigues for others. We live a quiet life, he says. In Normandy, in exile, he also says. My mother says the same thing, but more bitterly. Only in our architecture might you glimpse signs of the powerful familial trauma. We live a quiet life, but our courtyard resembles a battlefield, its ancient austerity insulted by a sea of trenches, fortifications, red mud, white sand, grey flagstones, and 54 forsythias with their roots bound up in balls of hessian. In order that the courtyard should reach its proper glory, the Austrian architect has been installed in the blue room with his drawing boards and pencils. You may glimpse this uppity creature as we pass. I have omitted mention of the most serious defect of my uncle's vehicle, the lack of steering. There are more faults besides, but who could really care? The two-wheeled Celery Fair was one of those dazzling machines that are initially mocked for their impracticality until, all in a great rush, like an Italian footman falling down a staircase, they arrive in front of us, unavoidably real and extraordinarily useful. The years before 1805, when I was first delivered to my mother's breast, constituted an age of inventions of great beauty and great terror, and I was very soon aware of all of this without knowing exactly what the beauty or the terror were. What I understood was drawn solely from what we call the symbolic aggregate. That is, the confluence of the secrets, the disturbing flavor of my mother's milk, my own breathing, the truly horrible and unrelenting lowing of the condemned cattle, which, particularly on winter afternoons, at that hour when the servants have once more failed to light the lanterns, distressed me beyond belief. But hundreds of words have been spent, and it is surely time to enter that chateau. Rolling quietly on our two wheels between two tall blue doors, where, having turned sharply right, we shall be catapulted along the entire length of the long, high gallery.
A popular read right now down under is Truth by Peter Temple. It's the eagerly awaited sequel to The Broken Shore, winner of the Golden Dagger Award for Best Crime Writing. Peter Temple is a former journalist and a journalism lecturer. Temple turned to fiction writing in the 1990s. He's won many awards for crime fiction, the most recent in 2006 for The Broken Shore, which also won the Australian Book Publishers Award for Best General Fiction. Temple is the first Australian to win a Gold Dagger. At the close of a long day, Inspector Stephen Villani stands in the bathroom of a luxury apartment high above the city. In the glass bath, a young woman lies dead, a panic button within her reach. Villani's life is his work, but now, over a few sweltering summer days, as fires burn across the state and his superiors and colleagues scheme and jostle, he finds all the certainties of his life are crumbling. If The Broken Shore was Temple's evolution from the world of hard-boiled crime fiction to poignant crime drama, then Truth is his evolution from poignant crime drama to crime epic masterpiece. No longer content with small settings and particular crimes, with Truth, Temple takes on the institutions charged with fighting crimes, the police, state politics, and the money men behind the politicians. What emerges is a complex narrative that follows the head of the Victorian State Homicide Unit as he tries to negotiate his career amongst a crumbling family life and a case with too many political implications. The title is read by Michael Carman.
"I'll tell the wife, hold the T-bones," Burkitt's ended the call. "Close this Altona thing in an hour," he said. "That's pretty neat for the clearance." Villani heard Singo. "The clearance rate. Worry about doing the job properly." Joe Cashin had thought he was doing the job properly, and it took the jaws to open the car embedded in the fallen house. Diab was dead. Cashin was breathing, but no hope. Too much blood lost. Too much broken and ruptured. Singleton only left the hospital to sit in his car. The old Falcon. He aged. Grey stubble sprouted. His silken hair went greasy. After the surgery, when they told him Joe had some small chance and allowed him into the room, he took Joe's slack hand, held it, kissed its knuckles. Then he stood, smoothed Joe's hair, bent to kiss Joe's forehead. Finucane was there. He was the witness, and he told Villani. They did not know that Singleton was capable of such emotions. The next time Cashin came out of hospital, the second time in 3 years, he was pale, as a barked tree. Singo was dead by then, a second stroke, and Villani was acting boss of homicide. "The clearance rate," Villani said. "A disappointment to me to hear you use the term." His phone. "Gavin Keeley, deputy head of homicide, 2 months in the job. We have a dead woman in the Presolio building. That's in the Docklands," he said. "Paul Dove's asked for assistance." "Why?" "Oh, it's out of his depth. I'm off to Auckland later, but I can go." "No," said Villani. "I bear this cross." He went down the passage into the bedroom. A bed big enough for four sleepers, mattress naked, pillows bare. Forensic had finished there. He picked up a pillow with his fingertips, sniffed it. Faintest smell of perfume. Deeper sniff. The other pillow. Different perfume. Slightly stronger smell. He walked through the empty dressing room into the bathroom, saw the glass bath, and beside it a bronze arm rising from the floor, its hand offering a cake of soap. She was on the plastic bag in a yoga posture of rest, legs parted, palms up, scarlet toenails, long legs, sparse pubic hair, small breasts. His view was blocked by the shoulder of a kneeling forensic tech. Balani stepped sideways and saw her face, recoiled. For a terrible, heart-jumping instant, he thought it was Lizzie. The resemblance was strong. He turned to the wall of glass, breathed out, his heart settled. The drab grey bay lay before him, and, between the heads, a pinhead, a container ship. Gradually it would show its ponderous shape, a huge, lolling, flat-topped steel slug, bleeding rust and oil and putrid waste. "Panic button," said Dove. He was wearing a navy suit, a white shirt and a dark tie, a neurosurgeon on his hospital rounds. Valani looked. Rubber, dimpled like a golf ball, set in the wall between the shower and the head of the bath. "Nice shower," said Dove. A stainless steel disc hung above a perforated square of metal. On a glass shelf, a dozen or more soap bars were displayed, as if for sale. The forensic woman said, "Broken neck. Bath's empty, but she's damp." She was new on the job, Canadian, a mannish young woman, no makeup, tanned, crew cut. "How do you break a neck in the bath?" said Valani. "Well, it's hard to do it yourself. Takes a lot to break a neck." "Really?" She didn't get his tone. "Absolutely. Takes force." "What else?" said Valani. "Nothing I can see now." "The time?" "Inspired guess." "Less than 24. Or I have to go back to school." "I'm sure they'll be pleased to see you." "Taking the water temperature into account?" "What?" Valani pointed. The small digital touchscreen at the door was set at 48 degrees. "Didn't see that," she said. "I would have, in due course." "No doubt." Little smile. "Okay, Lance," she said. "Zip it."
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Set during World War II in Germany, Marcus Suzak's groundbreaking novel, The Book Thief, is the story of Liesel Memminger, a foster girl living outside of Munich. Liesel scratches out a meager existence by stealing when she encounters something she can't resist. And she can't resist books. With the help of her accordion-playing foster father, she learns to read and shares her stolen books with her neighbors during bombing raids, as well as with the Jewish man hidden in her basement before he is marched to Dachau. This is an unforgettable story and amazingly popular in Australia. It's about the ability of books to feed the soul. Readers, there is great controversy from reviewers as to the young adult categorization of this book. Like To Kill a Mockingbird, the main characters are children, but the subject is quite mature. Alan Cordiner gets kudos for his brilliant narration of this much-beloved Australian title.
Needless to say, I vacation in increments, in colors. Still, it's possible that you might be asking, why does he even need a vacation? What does he need distraction from? Which brings me to my next point. It's the leftover humans, the survivors. They're the ones I can't stand to look at, although on many occasions I still fail. I deliberately seek out the colours to keep my mind off them, but now and then I witness the ones who are left behind, crumbling among the jigsaw puzzle of realisation, despair and surprise. They have punctured hearts. They have beaten lungs. Which, in turn, brings me to the subject I'm telling you about tonight, or today, or whatever the hour and colour. It's the story of one of those perpetual survivors, an expert at being left behind. It's just a small story, really, about, among other things, a girl, some words, an accordionist, some fanatical Germans, a Jewish fistfighter, and quite a lot of thievery. I saw the book thief 3 times. Beside the railway line. First up is something white, of the blinding kind. Some of you are most likely thinking that white is not really a colour and all of that tired sort of nonsense. Well, I'm here to tell you that it is. White is without question a colour, and personally, I don't think you want to argue with me. A reassuring announcement. Please, be calm, despite that previous threat. I am all bluster. I am not violent. I am not malicious. I am a result. Yes, it was white. It felt as though the whole globe was dressed in snow, like it had pulled it on, the way you pull on a sweater. Next to the train line, footprints were sunken to their shins. Trees wore blankets of ice. As you might expect, someone had died. They couldn't just leave him on the ground. For now it wasn't such a problem, but very soon the track ahead would be cleared and the train would need to move on. There were 2 guards. There was 1 mother and her daughter, 1 corpse. The mother, the girl, and the corpse remained stubborn and silent. "Well, what else do you want me to do?" The guards were tall and short. The tall one always spoke first, though he was not in charge. He looked at the smaller, rounder one, the one with the juicy red face. "Well," was the response, "we can't just leave them like this, can we?" The tall one was losing patience. "Why not?" And the smaller one damn near exploded. He looked up at the tall one's chin and cried, "Spinst du? Are you stupid?" The abhorrence on his cheeks was growing thicker by the moment. His skin widened. "Come on," he said, traipsing over the snow. "We'll carry all 3 of them back on if we have to. We'll notify the next stop." As for me, I had already made the most elementary of mistakes. I can't explain to you the severity of my self-disappointment. Originally, I'd done everything right. I studied the blinding white snow sky who stood at the window of the moving train. I practically inhaled it, but still, I wavered. I buckled. I became interested in the girl. Curiosity got the better of me, and I resigned myself to stay as long as my schedule allowed. And I watched. 23 minutes later, when the train was stopped, I climbed out with them. A small soul was in my arms. I stood a little to the right. The dynamic train guard duo made their way back to the mother, the girl, and the small male corpse. I clearly remember that my breath was loud that day. I'm surprised the guards didn't notice me as they walked by. The world was sagging now under the weight of all that snow. Perhaps 10 meters to my left, the pale, empty-stomached girl was standing, frost-stricken. Her mouth jittered. Her cold arms were folded. Tears were frozen to the book thief's face.
Australian-born Geraldine Brooks is an author and journalist who worked as a reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald. In 1982, she won an Australian News Correspondent Scholarship to the Journalism Master's Program at Columbia in New York. Later, she worked for the Wall Street Journal, where she covered crises in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. She was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction in 2006 for her novel, March. Years of Wonder, which we'll preview today, is an international bestseller. The story begins as an infected bolt of cloth brings the plague from London to an isolated village. Housemaid Anna Frith emerges as an unlikely heroine and healer. Through Anna's eyes, we follow the story of the fateful year of 1666, as she and her fellow villagers confront the spread of disease and superstition. As death reaches into every household and villagers turn from prayers to murderous witch hunts, Anna must find the strength to confront the disintegration of her community and the lure of illicit love. As she struggles to survive and grow, a year of catastrophe becomes instead a year of wonders. Inspired by the true story of Eyam, a village in the rugged hill country of England, Year of Wonders is a richly detailed evocation of a singular moment in history. Written with stunning emotional intelligence, Brooks, who narrates the books, blends love and learning, loss and renewal into a very memorable read.
A servant has no right to stay once she's dismissed. But I did stay, plumping the pillow, placing a shawl. He won't let me lay a fire. He won't let me give him even that little bit of comfort. Finally, when I'd run out of things to pretend to do, I left him. In the kitchen, I picked a couple of the spotted apples I'd culled from the buckets and walked out to the stables to see to his horse. The courtyard hadn't been swept in a senate. It smelled of rotting straw and horse piss. I had to hitch my skirt to keep it off the muck. Before I was halfway across, I could hear the thud of the horse's rump as he turned and strutted in his confinement, gouging clefts into the floor of the stall, because there's no one strong or skilled enough to handle him. The stable boy, whose job it was to keep the courtyard raked, was asleep on the floor of the tack room. He jumped when he saw me, making a great show of searching for the snath that had slipped from his hand when he dozed off. The sight of the scythe blade still upon his workbench vexed me, for I'd asked him to mend it long since, and the timothy now was naught but blown seed head and no longer worth the cutting. I was set to scold him about this, and about the filth outside, but his poor face, so pinched and exhausted, made me swallow the words. Dust motes sparkled in the sudden shaft of sunlight as I opened the stable door. The horse stopped his pawing, holding one hoof aloft and blinking in the unfamiliar glare. Then he reared up on his muscled haunches and punched the air, saying, as plainly as he could, "If you aren't him, get out of here." Although I don't know when a brush was last laid on him, his coat still gleamed like bronze where the light touched it. When Mr. Montpelion had arrived here on this horse, the common talk had been that such a fine stallion was no fit steed for a vicar, and people liked not to hear the rector calling him Anteros, after one of the old Puritans told them it was the name of a pagan idol. When I made so bold as to ask Mr. Montpelion about it, he had only laughed and said that even Puritans should recall that the pagans too are children of God, and their stories part of his creation. I stood with my back pressed against the stall, talking gently to that great horse. "Ah, I'm so sorry you're cramped up in here all day. I brought you a small something." Slowly, I reached into the pocket of my pinafore and held out an apple. He turned his massive head a little, showing me the whites of one liquid eye. I kept prattling softly, as I used to with the children when they were scared or hurt. "You like apples? I know you do. Go on, then, and have it." He pawed the ground again, but with less conviction. Slowly, his nostrils flaring as he studied the scent of the apple and of me, he stretched his broad neck towards me. His mouth was soft as a glove and warm as it brushed my hand, taking the apple in a single bite. As I reached into my pocket for the second one, he tossed his head and the apple juice sprayed. He was up now, angrily boxing the air, and I knew I'd lost the moment. I dropped the other apple on the floor of the stall and slid out quickly, resting my back against the closed door, wiping a string of horse spittle from my face. The stable boy slid his eyes at me and went silently on with his mending. Well, I thought, it's easier to bring a small comfort to that poor beast than it is to his master. When I came back into the house, I could hear that the rector was out of his chair, pacing. The rectory floors are old and thin, and I could follow his steps by the creak of the boards. Up and back he walked, up and back, up and back. If only I could get him downstairs to do his pacing in the garden. But once, when I suggested it, he looked as if I'd proposed something as outlandish as a trek up the White Peak. When I went to fetch his plate, the apple slices were all there, untouched, turning brown. Tomorrow, I'll start to work with the cider press. He'll take a drink without noticing sometimes, even when I can't get him to eat anything. And it's no use letting a cellar full of fruit go bad. If there's one thing I can't stand any more, it's the scent of a rotting apple.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Remember in the early 80s when we all turned on the tube to watch each and every episode of The Thornbirds? Gosh, that love story had us captivated. The angst, the sexual tension, our shameless lusting after a man of the cloth. Uh-huh.
Now, Colleen McCullough, best-selling author of The Thornbirds, brings us a grisly tale, Too Many Murders, set in 1967 during tense days at the height of the Cold War. One day, one city, 12 murders, but each murder seems different. Is this the gruesome work of one killer or many? Detective Chief Carmine Delmonico seems to have an unsolvable case on his hands. The title is read by Robert Garrett.
This time, Evan went through Tom's first without success. Then he opened the door to his own. In these walk-in closets, the architect's true genius showed best, for he was one of those men who never forgot any aspect of his past, nor failed to understand how much junk young men and women could accumulate during the course of a year occupying the same room. The walk-in closets ran the full length of the room and were 3 feet wide. At one end were racks of drawers, then came open shelves, then, for a full half of the area, vacant space. Only in the matter of lighting were they poorly equipped, as a result of the Dean's fear of fire in an enclosed area. 25-watt bulbs, no brighter. On springs, the doors closed after they were opened, yet another crotchet of the Dean's. He abhorred disorder and deemed open doors and drawers a danger, as well as a legal liability. Evan flicked the closet light on and stepped inside. The door swung shut behind him, but he was used to that. He saw the bundle at once, hanging from the ceiling on a cord. He rushed to it eagerly, not surprised that his victim had chosen to secrete it inside and inside, nor that it hung in an area where there were no drawers or shelves. He didn't look up at the ceiling. He looked no higher than the bundle, which even in the dim light he could see was bound tightly in sarin wrap. The notes showed through clearly. $100 bills. They seemed new, their edges unswollen by the abuse of many fingers as they sat in a neat, flat brick. Suddenly, his hands already grabbing at the brick, he stopped a moment to contemplate the magnitude of his coup, the triumph he couldn't confide to anyone else as long as he wanted to blackmail Motormouth. Did he want to continue the blackmail? After all, he didn't need the money. It was simply his choice of weapon. What he reveled in was the knowledge that he, Evan Pugh, a mere 19-year-old chub sophomore, had the power to torment another human being to the point of extreme mental torture. Oh, it was sweet. Of course he'd go on blackmailing Motormouth. His movement resumed. He took hold of the plastic-wrapped packet. When it didn't budge, he yanked at it sharply, an impatient jerk that saw it come away, drop downward to his hips. His hands followed, unwilling to give up their prize. In the same instant, there was a loud sound, incorporating both a roar and a swish. As the terrible pain invaded his upper arms and chest, Evan genuinely thought he'd been bitten by a Tyrannosaurus Rex. He dropped the brick of money and clutched at whatever was engulfing him, his fingers closing on cold steel fixed in his flesh, not one, but a whole row of daggers deep in his flesh, down past the bone. The shock had been too sudden for a scream, but now he began to scream, shrilly, hoarsely, wondering why his mouth was full of foam, but screaming, screaming, screaming. The noise percolated out of the closet into the room, but there was no one present to hear it. That it didn't penetrate into the corridor was due to the architect, very much aware of soundproofing, and endowed besides with a bounteous budget. The Parsons wished something really first class if they had to part with a Rodin and some Henry Moores. Those couldn't possibly be housed in or near rubbish. It took Evan Pugh 2 hours to die, his lifeblood leaking away, his legs refusing to work, his breathing one distressed gasp after another. His only consolation as consciousness left him was that the police would find the money and Motormouth's letter still in his pocket.
"I don't believe it!" Captain Carmine Delmonico exclaimed. "And the day isn't even over yet! What time is it, for God's sake?"
"Getting on for 6:30.
Came Patrick O'Donnell's voice from inside the closet.
"As you well know."
Carmine stepped through the door with its spring now disconnected and into a surreal scene that looked as if it had been posed for Major Minor's Waxworks Horror Museum.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Good day again, mates. I am now in a bookstore in Cairns by the Great Barrier Reef, and I've stumbled onto the top 10 list for Australian fiction. Here goes. The first book is Howard Jacobson, The Finkler Question, which, according to the sign I'm seeing, is winner of the Man Booker Prize for 2010. Next is a popular one, and I know you know it as well, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. We've reviewed that. Number 3, A Kingdom Besieged by Raymond Feist. Number 4, The Brightest Star in the Sky by Marion Keyes. Don't know that one. Number 5, The Little Coffee Shop of Kabul by Deborah Rodriguez. This says a heartwarming novel about a little cafe in Kabul and the 5 extraordinary women who meet there. Number 6, Toys by James Patterson. Apparently, he gets read all over the world. Number 7, same story, worth dying for, Lee Child, another Jack Reacher novel. Number 8, the popular The Girl Who Played with Fire by Stieg Larsson. Number 9, TikTok by James Patterson. And number 10,
The Lost Symbol by Dan Brown, the eagerly awaited sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Now we're going to look over on the nonfiction side. Number one for nonfiction is The SAS Sniper, The World of an Elite Australian Marksman by Rob Mailer. Number two, a business book, Good Boss, Bad Boss, How to Be the Best and Learn from the Worst. It's written by Robert Sutton. Number three, this is an interesting title that I haven't heard of. Maybe you have. It's called Some Girls by Jillian Lauren. And it's actually the story of an 18-year-old NYU theater school dropout who ended up in Singapore and who spent 18 months in the harem of a prince and the youngest brother of the Sultan of Brunei. Okay, number four, My Life Story by Ben Cousins. Now, Ben Cousins is one of the premier personalities in Australian sports, but seems that he's as well known for what he does off the football field as on it. He's a self-confessed drug addict whose binges on cocaine, ice, and crack would last for days. Anyway, that's number four, My Life Story by Ben Cousins. Number five, My Bookie Wook by Russell Brandt. It's a series of embarrassing incidents. The cover says, a scandalous memoir that is better written and more entertaining than any of the celebrity autobiographies that clog the shelves. Number six, The 4-Hour Working Week by Timothy Ferris. Book says, escape the 9-to-5, live anywhere, and join the new rich. Number seven, The Brain That Changes Itself by Dr. Norman Dodge. It's an immensely moving, inspiring book that will permanently alter the way we look at our brains, human nature, and human potential. Number eight is a book we know very well in the States, Life by Keith Richards. Number nine, The 4-Hour Body, another one by Timothy Ferris, a revolutionary approach to body transformation. And number 10, Scar Tissue by Anthony Kiedis, an honest and moving account of a man who almost destroyed himself. So that's it from Cairns, Australia, and the book reading world.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Readers, can we talk about Australian literature and not talk about surfing? Breath is Tim Winton at his finest, a beautiful, gripping, deeply moving novel about our need for excitement and our propensity to push ourselves to the limit. It's about the power of the sea and how ordinary people live with tragedy. Breath opens with Bruce Pike, a paramedic, arriving too late to save a teenage boy's life. Pike's partner wonders why the boy killed himself, but Pike knows he didn't. He doesn't know the boy, but he knows the story. He lives with the legacy of his own adolescence. As kids, when Pike and his pals started to surf, they were terrified and they were immediately addicted. Among the local surfers, one guy stood out. He turned up alone when the swells were the highest and left the rest of them in his wake. Gradually, the young Pike gets to know this loner, a guy called Sando. Sando takes him under his wing, showing him secret beaches and ever bigger waves. He taught the boy about surfing and about life. In the endless search for the biggest wave, the biggest high, some riders don't make it. Half a lifetime later, Pike can't free himself from this truth.
Dan Wiley narrates this powerful coming-of-age story.
June, I'm not the police. They're already on their way. Can I open the wardrobe? I ask as Jody steps into the doorway. I prefer that you didn't, says June. Okay, but you know that the police will. Do they have to? The mother looks at me properly for the first time. She's a handsome woman in her 40s with short dark hair and arty pendant earrings. And I can imagine that an hour ago, when her lipstick and her life were still intact, she'd have been erect and confident, even a little haughty. It's their job, June. You seem to have made some kind of assumption. June, I say, glancing up at Jody. Let's just say I've seen a few things in my time. Honestly, I couldn't begin to tell you. Then you'll tell me how this happened. Why he's done this to himself. I've called for another car, says Jody. Yeah, good, I mutter. June, this is Jody. She's my partner tonight. Go ahead and tell me why. Because your husband's broken his collarbone, says Jody. He broke down the door here, right? So what do I tell them? The mother asks, ignoring Jody altogether. That's really for you to decide, I say. But there's no shame in the truth. It's fairer on everybody. The woman looks at me again. I squat in front of her beside the bed. She smooths the skirt down onto her knees. I must be transparent, she murmurs. I try to give her a kindly smile, but my face feels stiff. Behind her, I can see the usual posters on the wall. Surfers, rock stars, women in provocative poses. The bookshelf above the desk has its sports trophies and souvenirs from Bali, and the computer goes through a screensaver cycle of the Twin Towers endlessly falling. She reaches for my hand and I give it to her. She feels no warmer than her dead son. No one will understand. No, I say. Probably not. You're a father? Yes, I am. Car doors slam in the street below. June, would you like a moment alone with Aaron before the police come in? I've had my moment, she says, letting go of my hand to pat her hair abstractedly. Jody, will you just pop down and let the police know where we are? Jody folds her arms petulantly but goes with a flick of her little blonde ponytail. That girl doesn't like you. Nah, not much. So what do? I can't advise you, June. I've got other children to consider. Yes. And a husband? He will have to go to hospital, I'm afraid. Lucky him. I get to my feet and collect my kid. She stands and brushes her skirt down and gazes back at the boy on the bed. Is there anyone else you'd like me to call? Jody and two cops appear at the door. Call, says June. You can call my son back. As you can see, he's not listening to his mother. When we're almost back to the depot for knockoff, Jody breaks the silence. So when were you planning to let me know what all that was about? All what? With that poor woman. For a moment there, I thought you were flirting with her. Well, you can add that to your list of complaints. Look, I'm sorry. Arrogant, aloof, sexist, bad communicator, gung-ho. Obviously, I've missed a few things coming in late. But for the record, Jody, I'm not a Vietnam vet. Believe it or not, I'm not old enough.
It's a big world of literature out there, so thanks so much for journeying down under with us today. Check out all of our recent titles at bookreportradio.com. This is your host, Elaine Charles, and I'll see you back here next week for the next installment of The Book Report. Baby,